The post-mortem has begun on a historic set of local elections, but where does each party go from here? Is Reform unstoppable? Is Kemi the one to lead the Conservative rebuild? Do Labour really get it? Tomorrow, 7th of May, join the Spectator's panel and special guests Zia Yusuf and Jacob Rees-Mogg to unpack these questions, as well as the broader impact of the locals on British politics. For tickets, go to www.spectator.co.uk/coffeehouselive.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Oscar Edmondson and I'm joined today by James Heal and Rachel Wolfe, former advisor to Boris Johnson. Now, it's day five of recriminations after the local elections as politicians, pollsters and journalists alike try to make sense of what just happened. But Rachel, you have a very interesting take. Can you tell us why we should not be surprised why Reform did so well?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's interesting. It feels kind of banal to me, but maybe it's interesting, which is I don't understand why everyone is so surprised, or rather the performative surprise that we go through in every single one of these elections feels like it's getting a little old. We have had a very large group of voters who, for entirely understandable reasons, have been expressing their displeasure with the state of affairs since at least the Brexit referendum in 2016. And at every single moment, they have voted to change that state of affairs. The policy environment has not changed. We have not delivered all the things that we promised in each of those elections. And they're still really angry and they are still voting for change. And that seems to me wholly predictable because none of the things they want have happened.
And what are those things? What are the things that these voters want?
Well, I'll come to the kind of economy and stuff in a minute, but I think there is a little bit of a temptation to say, well, I know these voters say that they care about immigration, but actually, guys, I promise it's not immigration. It's dissatisfaction reason 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And there are some of the dissatisfaction reasons, and I'll come back to them. But if people say to you consistently enough in enough elections, and remember that they have voted for the party that promised to bring down immigration in every election, at least since 2010, I can't remember 2005, and it keeps going up a lot more than people expected, at some point, I think you have to believe them. You might disagree with them, but you have to believe them. So there's no doubt in my mind that immigration, certainly illegal, but also legal, is a big driver of what is going on here. And that is not just social, although it is partly social. It is also economic, because a lot of these people believe that immigration depresses wages and siphons off public funds from the things that they care about into, for example, paying for asylum seekers in hotels where they would like to be having their wedding. So immigration is a big part of this.
Mm.
I think the second is that in a narrow sense, we've obviously had the cost of living crisis driven by huge amounts of inflation. The prices haven't come down. Inflation might be reducing, but in prices have not come down and people still feel enormously squeezed. And again, they feel like they keep getting promised sunlit uplands and change. And yet what they get are either more inflation or tax rises that they may feel are deeply unfair. And the third is they are promised better public services, and yet they feel they can't get a GP appointment and everything is crashing. So from their point of view, things keep getting a bit worse and they're walking through their town centres and everything looks grim. So there is a lot for them to be dissatisfied about. I suppose what I want to slightly push on, though, is the view that if you fix those things and you get the economy growing, you don't have to worry about immigration. And I am not convinced that is true.
James, the immediate response from the government has, of course, been, we get it. We're going to go further and faster. From what you've been picking up from Labour circles, what does that entail? Are they picking up on these points that Rachel sets out?
I certainly think there's some frustration at the top levels of government about how, for instance, the OBR does its calculations in terms of rewarding high levels of migration in terms of forecasts for growth. So we currently have this great game of sort of trying to please Richard Hughes, who's the chairman of the OBR, and the institution itself, and trying to sort of offer up sort of almost sort of sacrifices to the gods and to try and get this magical forecast and then say the line's going in the right way. As a result of that, that's something shared within Labour circle as well. So I think that there'll be some pressure looking at the sort of modelling in which how the OBR does its calculations. But what was so striking from the Times piece that Keir Starmer wrote at the weekend was how he basically argued that there was going to be three main issues for the next election: the economy, the NHS, and immigration. That is a similar phrase to what I've heard, you know, senior conservatives say as well. They think it'll be those three issues. And on each of those three, reform have quite a simple narrative, which they can talk about immigration. You could talk about the cost of immigration on public services. You could talk about the facts I've just said, that you had multiple records broken because of hundreds of thousands of people come since COVID, etc. And that hasn't, at the same time, they've seen anemic economic growth. And so I think that immigration is going to be something that where reform has all the best students to an extent. And I think we've seen that in terms of the last 72 hours or so, in terms of reform's response to these local elections. There's going to be lots of battle lines drawn over migrant hotels. The Home Office is going to want to put people who've arrived here, asylum seekers, illegal migrants, into hotels across the country. Reform have signalled they're going to make this a battle line. They're going to have massive resistance to this. And it doesn't almost matter in a way. If you go to court, for instance, and there's an injunction, the Home Office tries that, you know, Reform will turn around on the doorstep and say, your Labour government is battling against your local council to put migrants here. They're spending hundreds of thousands of taxpayer pounds on this. Do you really want to vote for them in 2029? Mm-hmm. So I think there is far too much, to use the online phrase, copium, but shall we say more hope than expectation among the two main parties about how reform is going to fare in office. I think it actually offers them ample opportunities. I think it kind of breaks the habit some voters have of voting for the two main parties. And I think that reform know all of this. And so they're going to start picking fights on things like local flags. Do you want to have, you know, the Union Jack and the St. George's Cross? That would poll pretty highly among voters, even though, of course, there's more nuance with county flags and Ukraine flag. I completely get all that. But reform are happy to have that debate on their turf.
If you genuinely believe that reform will now be judged by how they run their councils, you would have to believe that the local elections we just had were a judgment on how people ran their councils.
Yes.
And they very visibly were not, right?
Yes.
There was nothing. I mean, it's sad. I think we're a massively centralized country, and I think it's terrible for all these very hardworking people. But there was nothing about these votes which was a judgment on the specific council's performance, except in a tiny number of areas. This was a national vote. And therefore, the way in which reform is going to get judged is by the way they play into national issues. I completely agree with you, James.
To come back on that point as well, I spoke to a former Labour minister at the weekend who made the point to use the most shocking examples of local mismanagement is the kind of grooming gang scandals that we've seen across the country over the past 10 years or so. That didn't stop people from voting Labour last year. The second point to make is I thought the sort of interesting analysis in, I was reading for my sins, the Times election book over the weekend as well, which Rawlings and Thrasher analysed. Yeah,
well, I have a great weekend.
Thank you. I have friends as well. They're just not in the room with me now. But which Rawlings and Thrasher analyse and say, for instance, you know, there was no distinction in terms of the swing against Tory MPs by how their own political complexion. You know, Marc Francois, for instance, red and blood, you know, meat, sort of a Brexiteer type Tory, went from 25,000 majority in 2019 to 5,000 last time. There seems to be little evidence to suggest that Castle Point, I think the same was true of Rebecca Harris's seat. People weren't going out there, and as you were sort of saying, Rachel, that, you know, distinguishing on in that election on ideology or distinguishing on competence in terms of local governments, you know, this is an issue which affects everyone, and it doesn't really matter necessarily what the local specifics are in that sense.
Rachel, I did want to make use of the fact that we've got you here, your experience with Boris Johnson, because we had Luke Trill on the podcast over the weekend. He was talking about some of the polling that he'd been doing, and he was saying that a lot of people were pointing out that Boris Johnson still comes up as a big thing for these voters that you're talking about, the sort of anti-political silent majority. They're really sort of liking his Trumpian Teflon quality. As someone who worked with him, do you think there is any chance of him coming back? And how do you think that would work for the Conservative Party?
Yeah, so I'll go with where I agree with Luke and where I disagree with Luke. Boris, unquestionably, a bit like Farage, probably even more than Farage, has extraordinary political charisma and ability that I certainly haven't seen in another British politician in my political lifetime. And so instinctively, yes, you do think he could punch through and communicate, as he always did, in a way that other politicians can't. But I suspect there is a difference between what the immediate day one impact of Boris coming back would be and how it would play out over a number of years. And I think, given everything we just discussed, it would be difficult for a party to back the leader who made all of the decisions that have made people quite so enraged. And who fundamentally believed in those decisions, right? Boris doesn't think immigration should go down. He thinks it should go up. He likes high immigration, and he's fundamentally, you know, somewhat liberal in various positions. And you can agree with that or disagree with it, but it is who he is. So I'm a little skeptical over a longer period that that would work. But you can't deny his astonishing political abilities. I've worked with lots of politicians I really admire, including your editor, who I really admire. And he has great qualities as well. But like Boris has this ability to speak to the public. And I Of course. I just think it would die on this occasion.
On that immigration point, do you think that people actually attribute the Boris wave to Boris?
I think they would after a three-year battle with Nigel Farage.
And also Keir Starmer echoing those criticisms as well, as we've already seen. Number 10 did a whole sort of bully pulpit press conference a few months ago. I think it was Kemi's first press conference as well, when they talked about how they let uncontrolled migration get out of control. But I think this goes back to a point Rachel made in that excellent Politico piece, which I'm told is circulating with approval and people are thinking one of the best things written about it by internal reform people. Nigel Farage, his aim at this next election is to do what Joseph Chamberlain did 100 years ago and be the man who broke two political parties. And in that inspires Churchill's phrase, you know, the man who made the political weather. Right now, Nigel Farage is the man making the political weather in British politics. And I thought it was really striking and quite extraordinary timing that this afternoon, it seems that the Indian-UK free trade deal has been signed. And I'm just going to quote briefly from the Indian press release on the trade deal and side deals. In an unprecedented achievement, India has secured an exemption for Indian workers who are temporarily in the UK and their employers from paying social security contributions in the UK for a period of 3 years under the Double Contribution Convention. This will make Indian service providers significantly more competitive in the UK. Now, obviously, this is a press release intended for domestic political consumption. We will need to see the full workings and all of this. But again, it just seems 5 days after an election in which immigration clearly was at the forefront of many people's minds. And of course, let's remember, you know, Nigel Farage was very careful in his rhetoric throughout the whole campaign, emphasising how kind of low stakes, low cost voting reform would be up until the final week, of course, when he switched at Dover and started talking about migration to get the vote out, to energise his base. But this, I think, will be extraordinary. And everything will be seen through that perceived lens of Nigel Farage and how he's going to make the political weather and all this. And I think the free trade deal is going to be one part of it. And again, that is almost a sort of hangover, these kind of deals in some respects, from the kind of Boris Global Britain Liberal Leave agenda. And I just wonder perhaps if things like that, where effectively it seems that Indian workers will be more preferential for some UK businesses who don't want to pay the newly hiked national insurance costs, thank you Rachel Reeves, as a result of that, that will therefore look like you're putting British people behind other people. And so I think that is a powerful narrative that reform will certainly lean into. And as Rachel's piece in Politico, you know, correctly identifies, it's going to be a whole swathe of areas, including higher education, visa liberalisation, and future trade deals as well.
You talked about public services earlier. Mm. And I remember when I was working on various policies before 2019, there's a polling technique called conjoint where you divorce out different factors, see what matters most to people. You try out different kind of platforms against randomized other ones, see what people care about most. And at the time, what was striking is that in some ways, the most popular health policy and the most popular welfare policies were immigration policies. So the most popular health policy was restricting use of the NHS to people who hadn't paid in. The most popular welfare policy was restricting use of welfare to people who hadn't paid in. You may remember before Brexit, there was this huge furore about people coming in from Europe. And because we don't have a contributory welfare system, unlike other countries in Europe, they immediately got access to things. There were all those stories about people sending child benefit at home, which then got tightened up. Because it enrages people who feel that there's this fundamental principle that you have to contribute to get out. And it's deeply unfair. And if there is one kind of rock that runs through the British public still, I think, it is this belief in fairness that some immigration policy feels like it completely contributes. So I think it is potentially explosive, that.
Massively so. And I think that if you listen to focus groups and what pollsters are saying, people feel the system's rigged against them and they're being deeply ripped off. And of course, you know, you'll have a lot of liberal politicians. They'll be saying, you know, this is an issue of fairness. But of course, fairness cuts both ways. And so I think that I would caution those politicians in Labour and Conservatives. You know, for instance, Luke Akehurst wrote a piece over the weekend, of course, MP for Durham, having just seen his, you know, County Durham go teal after 100 years of, before 2021, voting deep red. You know, he was saying, oh, of course, reform now have to deliver an office. Well, I think, first of all, you know, as we've just discussed in this podcast, you know, I'm not necessarily sure local government will be the way in which they go. And I think actually it's a kind of useful stepping stone to Wales and Scotland, slightly bigger budgets next year, et cetera, before teeing up for the great mother of all clashes in 2029. But second of all, you know, a lot of voters would turn around and say, look, you know, if you think you've been doing such great governance, mate, you know, think again.
Well, thank you, James. Thank you, Rachel. And thank you very much for listening.